You're listening to The Jackie Daily Show. Follow me online at jackiedaily.com, on Facebook and on Twitter at Jackie Daily Show, and subscribe for free. iHeartRadio, Spotify, and most other places where quality podcasts are found. All right, coming up this hour, I'm going to speak with Daniel Turner. He's the executive director of Power the Future. You've seen him on Fox News. He's one of my favorites at Energy Commentary. He's going to talk about Joe Biden's new commitment through his executive order to convert the federal government to net zero carbon emissions by 2050. And that includes your U.S. military. Can you imagine that? So diesel, for example, has been the fuel of choice in a theater of war for over 100 years. And there's a really good reason. You can transport it. It has great temperature tolerance. It goes everywhere. Now, apparently, we're going to amass solar-powered tanks. Solar-powered tanks. Imagine that. The Germans have been using solar-powered tanks on their panzers during World War II in cloudy, cold Europe. I don't think so. You don't want to be the first American to try out solar-powered tanks in a theater of war. You don't want your kids or your grandkids doing it either. Of course, Biden will not be around to hold accountable in 2050 if we never reach this goal. In fact, I don't know if he'll be around in 2030, frankly. I'm not being unkind. I'm just saying, you know, it's easy to be a pacifist, Amish person when you're living in the center of the greatest military power in the world. It's also easy to be a president in favor of net zero carbon in 2050 when you won't be here to be held accountable. But what it does do is create an expectation among the business community that if they go green, they'll get federal money. If they don't, they'll be bankrupt. That's what it's meant to signal. And Mr. Biden's approval is now at 57%. And no one is surprised. And now I'm seeing the New York Times telling him, hey, announce now that you're not running again so that we don't have a default Ms. Harris as candidate, because that could be disastrous for Democrats, according to the New York Times. I'm seeing it right now on the screen as I speak. Back to next hour. It will be Dr. Brent Bennett from the Texas Public Policy Foundation talking about the fact that our solutions here in Texas to prevent that winter storm outage that killed hundreds of Texans, apparently is now being upended by our Public Utility Commission. Basically, the legislature and the executive branch, the governor, said we're going to have a firming requirement for wind and solar. So if you produce unreliable energy, you'd better have a backup, like natural gas, to give us power when the people need it to save their lives. And that's going to be a requirement. And apparently the Public Utility Commission has now said that since the statute doesn't absolutely mandate it, they're going to take that off the table. Sorry, Texas. Now, the Public Utility Commission has done some other things right. Some of the improvements that were simple that have happened since the storm is, for example, you can't cut off power to a power plant in the middle of a power outage. When you roll the blackout, don't hit the power plants of West Texas first. Can you believe that? They shut down natural gas production from its source at a time when we needed natural gas production, and then the plants froze. That's one of many things that went wrong. That's not going to happen anymore. And it costs $0 to fix that. I'm embarrassed to admit it as a Texan, but that's kind of what happened. It's part of what happened. Also, I promote the upcoming film by my friend Phelan McAleer, the investigative journalist and filmmaker. It's called My Son Biden. No, My Son, My Son Hunter. They've corrected me three times. MySonHunter.com. MySonHunter.com. This is about the billion-dollar deal that Hunter Biden did with China to ensure that China wins the energy race up against U.S. Fossil fuel producers and others. This is not fiction. This is real. This is a story that was covered in 2020 by the conservative press, but only now is the New York Times getting around to telling everyone about Hunter's billion-dollar deal with the Chinese. And again, it's a deal about fossil fuels. The Bidens, that's Hunter and his uncle, go around the world, Ukraine, China, wherever, advising and boosting foreign oil producers or fossil fuel producers. And their dad, his dad, attacks American producers. That is the competition to the people that Hunter is being paid by. You see what I mean? So Phelan McAleer is doing a film about this and other facts about Hunter Biden. Check him out at mysonhunter.com. And then I will tell you about this new UN climate panel, which apparently the World Health Organization will set up to address binding legal agreements regarding the pandemic. So this will be another permanent problem with a permanent body designed to, you know, solve the problem for you, but it never gets solved. Just like the IPCC, the International Panel on Climate Change, which likes to dish out mandates. It doesn't really have the power to do that, but apparently this body would. And, you know, it could enforce global lockdowns. It could mandate surveillance, like the kind you see to track COVID in South Africa or Botswana. It could mandate vaccine manufacturing infrastructure or things like this. Even the Washington Post is calling this pandemic treaty a radical idea in a headline. The headline itself calls it radical because it is. It would take away the power of people like Governor Ron DeSantis to give us freedom in the midst of this pandemic. And it would not be required to, you know, have results or solve problems. It would become a self-lobbying organization like the IPCC. It's very concerning. It would be a forfeiture of sovereignty and wealth, no doubt. And listen, these lockdowns are the biggest enemy of American oil and gas out there. I mean, it was the lockdown that caused the economy to tank because people weren't buying gasoline. They weren't buying jet fuel. They weren't using as much electricity. And so a lot of oil and gas producers in this country went under because of the lockdown. Again, not because of COVID, but because of COVID policy. Two very different things. And I'll be the first to say that I don't think our governor, Abbott, here in Texas, did the greatest job. I mean, he was talking about statewide lockdowns when it takes 11 hours to drive across this state. You know, there were counties totally untouched with not a single confirmed case of COVID. And he's locking down the whole place. You know, maybe the local authorities could have restrictions in the bigger cities at the very beginning. We didn't know if we'd seeded, you know, huge cases of COVID to overrun the hospitals, but most of the state did not need restrictions. And so this governor took a more heavy hand than a lot of people realize. Texas gets credit sometimes for being the best at certain things when, in fact, we're not the best. One of my jobs is to make us better and to point out when we're not as free as we should be. And that was one example. And then finally, I'll share just a little sampling of the work of Jørn Lomborg, the president of the Copenhagen Consensus, a visiting fellow at the Hoover Institution. Just a little piece from his book, False Alarm, How Climate Change Panic Costs Us Trillions, Hurts the Poor, and Fails to Fix the Planet. He is a lifelong environmentalist and very thoughtful guy, and I think you will enjoy him. And then, finally, I will do a defense of free speech. That almost seems like it should happen every week now. We're under attack, and we have to preserve the culture of free speech, because otherwise, even though the precedents at the U.S. Supreme Court are probably better than they've ever been in defense of speech and religious liberty, First Amendment rights, We are only one generation away from losing it if the culture changes, if they pack the court. You know, presidents will work their way up into the courts. They can reverse the precedent with one case. If you have activist judges who do not honor the rule of law, who, when I say activist, what I mean is, instead of saying what the law is, which is their job, they'll say what the law should be, which is the legislature's job. And they end up operating as this miniature legislature, kind of an oligarchy. So I think it's incumbent upon us right now, like now's the time to fight. Now is the time to speak up as often as you can in defense of speech, no matter who doesn't like it, inasmuch as it is legal. Legal. As if it's legal, I defend it. Okay? In fact, free speech is for, free speech guarantees are for unpopular speech and minority speech. It's there to protect them. The majority does not need protection. So it's actually the speech you don't like. It's always been protected from the start. That was the idea. You're listening to the Jackie Daly Show. We'll be right back. You're listening to the Jackie Daly Show. Find me at JackieDaly.com and on Twitter at Jackie Daly Host. Your president, Mr. Biden, just does not stop. He has endless energy when it comes to revolutionizing life as we know it, such as setting net zero carbon goals by 2050. This is the one thing he's actually apparently attempting to get done. It's an executive order that I'm sure will cost you a lot of money and sovereignty and peace and freedom. Echoing what happened or what we promised over in Scotland at that last big climate summit, my friend Daniel Turner, who is the executive director of Power the Future, has been commenting, and he's one of the most astute observers, certainly of federal policy, in the press. He's a media star. I see him on TV now. Like every time I turn on the television, there he is, Daniel Turner, Power the Future. Welcome back.
Oh, Jackie, it's great to be on your show again. Thank you very much.
Absolutely. So, Daniel, it's your opinion that what the president is doing with these new goals of net zero by 2050 chips away at our greatness and emboldens our enemies. Explain that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is a nonsense executive order. First, it's funny to note that it is an executive order.
Right.
Because they don't have the will in Congress. No one wants to put their name on this legislation. No one wants to vote. And so you would think with controlling both houses of Congress, they could get something done the correct way, but they can't. So it's an executive order. And these are the types of executive orders that just weaken our country. We look at our adversaries, our biggest adversary being China, the rate at which they are building coal plants for electricity because they want to power their manufacturing sector, which is our manufacturing sector, right? We sent it to China, unfortunately. Past politicians did. They don't want to risk blackouts. They want their country to function. You look at what Russia's doing with their incursions in the Ukraine and the Arctic Circle. They're trying to get more fossil fuels because they're trying to protect their country and they're trying to build up their country. So this executive order is forcing the government to use unreliable, expensive, foreign-made green energy. Why? For whose benefit, right? It's not for the government's benefit, for the American people's benefit. It really just makes the government weak and ineffective.
Well, and by contrast, they try to make it seem like every civilized nation would be on board with this and that we'd all be on the same page. So they would say, you know, well, sure, you can point to China as a bad actor, and a lot of people, you know, kind of accept it out of them for some reason. But hey, I'm looking at a story here. It says Australia vows to sell coal, quote, for decades. Here's their response, quote, yeah. We have said very clearly, we are not closing coal mines and we're not closing coal-fired power stations, says Australian Minister for Resources Keith Pitt. And that is why we will continue to have markets for decades into the future. If they're buying, we're selling.
Yeah.
You know, so the Australians, they're a strange country. sometimes so bold, you know, on some things, and sometimes bold in the wrong direction. It's a really interesting culture. But in any event, we are not exactly leading and causing our adversaries to shake in their boots. I saw this comment that you have in a press release of, you know, as Vlad Putin is amassing troops at the Ukrainian border, Joe Biden is focusing on amassing solar-powered tanks. Solar-powered tanks. And I thought I was paying attention, but I'm like, what? We're doing this now? Okay. Is this real, Daniel? I mean,
well, this is the thing that scares us about this executive order is there is no carve out for the military. It says all of the government
that's right.
by this year.
So
at least our current military doesn't operate on anything but fossil fuels, except for our Navy, which operates very heavily on nuclear power.
So
if there are no exceptions for this, what does that mean for our military? Do you recall Kamala Harris not long ago when she was the commencement speaker? I think it was the Naval Academy, talked about how great it is that Marines will one day be able to pull out solar-powered battery packs to charge their equipment. And a bunch of the people who have actually been in the military, know anything about the military, laughed and said, so am I supposed to like lay this thing out all day and charge it while the sun is out? Well, normally I'm busy when the sun is out because I'm fighting a war. And then what do I do at nighttime if I haven't charged it? It doesn't work. So no, we don't want these solar paneled things. This is the type of equipment that makes sense in Washington think tanks.
Yeah.
But in reality, this isn't going to work. And just like in reality, Joe Biden's executive order is not going to work.
Well, and I will say, I actually have a little bit of professional experience in the renewables in the military space. I actually was working as a consultant for a defense firm and contracting firm. And there was this huge call for solar powered bases, or at least we're talking about backup power for the bases. And even in a theater of war, and I will be, you know, totally circumspect and fair here. The leader of this company was a colonel, or had been, in the U.S. Reserve, I guess it was Army Reserves. And he said that, you know, we all know that diesel has been the fuel of choice for a theater of war for a long time because it's transportable. It does a lot. It has a lot of temperature endurance or tolerance, whatever. He explained that in Iraq, the only casualties his unit took was when transporting fuel from place to place, right? So most of the time when they're moving fuel, he said, in his case. And he said, if only we'd had microgrids, solar-powered microgrids in the desert, I would not have had to have moved as many people and as much fuel, and we'd have fewer casualties. Okay, I see the point there. And so if that's a backup plan, or you want to do it in the desert where it might make some sense, I'm not exactly opposed. But tanks, I'm just imagining World War II, right? And, you know, you're in Northern Europe, and we know how well solar works in Northern Europe. Ask the Germans, right? They're always the first to go first into bad ideas, and they also built some of the finest tanks. I'll bet you the Germans don't have solar-powered tanks. Well, okay, fine. To be fair, we took a lot of weapons away from them. They're not exactly allowed to accumulate weapons these days. But I know they're looking at me kind of funny from across the room, but I'm saying, you know what? There's probably a time and place for certain things like this, but net zero means net zero, not net 50%, net zero. And so I would say solar-powered tanks would probably be required to meet that. And even then, right? What's the carbon footprint of manufacturing a solar-powered tank? It's not zero. Not even close.
Exactly.
Not even close.
And net zero is just a such a fake term anyway, because the manufacturing of a lot of these renewable products uses more fossil fuels than the actual products themselves would emit if they were just used conventionally for either electricity or for combustion or for transportation. And the point you're raising about the military is a really important one. We shouldn't be conducting experiments on the military, right? I mean,
right,
we saw in the previous administration and in the current administration, We have a lot of sociological transgender experiments happening in the military, and now we're going to play with power experiments in the military. And let's see if we can run. Imagine if you posited that to parents and said, "Hey, we're going to see if your kid's school can be the first one to run on wind or solar panel." A lot of parents would say, "Okay, but if it doesn't work, what's the backup plan for my kid?" Well, the backup plan is your kid doesn't learn that day. And parents would say, "I don't want my kids being the experiment." So it's curious that we use the military, which I wish the military was dormant, right? I wish they were able to take a break. But we're not, right? We ended the war on terror only to watch the Russians and the Chinese amass enormous armies. The president's talking about ground troops in the Ukraine to protect the Ukrainian border. The most sacred of all the borders in the world is the Ukrainian border. And so why are we conducting these experiments on our national security and with the lives of 18 and 19-year-old Iowa farm boys? Haven't enough of them died in military experiments, whether it's forever wars, whether it's regime change, regardless? And so it's just shameful that these are the ones who are going to feel the brunt of sociological experiments.
Well, that's for sure, because who wants to be the first to line up to test out these solar-powered tanks in a theater of war? And worse, who wants to be the first to put their kids in a solar-powered tank to go up against a diesel-powered opposing side? And so the answer is no one. That would be completely inhumane and ridiculous, and especially if it were anywhere other than, you know, the height of the desert where you get the best sun. You know, I keep in mind, the idea for use of solar that I was working on was not about fighting in a theater exactly or combat. It was about, you know, powering a base. Which even, you know, I don't know, even that only makes so much sense, and it only makes sense as backup power. But it was these plans were all the rage even 10 years ago in Washington. Yep. So this has had a long run-up time. Let me take a break, and when we come back, we'll continue the conversation with Daniel Turner. He's the executive director of Power the Future. The Jackie Daly Show, and I'm continuing a conversation with Daniel Turner. He's the executive director of Power the Future. We're talking about Joe Biden's new executive order setting new goals for the federal government to achieve net zero carbon emissions by 2050. And it is across the entire federal government. We're talking about the military too, which where we left off was, you know, does that mean solar powered tanks? And who wants to be the first to try those out in a theater of war? You know, Daniel, it's tough to ignore the fact that when you mandate something that is brand new and frankly unachievable, the program will go on forever and a lot of people will make a lot of money. You point out that what Biden is doing is forcing the federal government to buy products and services from his green donors. And that explains it all, I think, right? Like, otherwise, how can you explain? He takes us from energy independence to dependence, right? He cancels pipelines and then wonders why we have a problem with supply and prices and inflation that results from that. I mean, people are asking themselves all the time, what is going on? How do we make any sense of his actions? Daniel, I think that you hit the nail on the head. That's, I don't know that I need to know more than that. He has green donors who, what you give a couple thousand dollars to his campaign. Maybe your PAC gives 50 grand, and in exchange, you become a billionaire or a multimillionaire in your little defense contracting company because you're doing green solutions. I mean, has anyone written this up where you can check who are the donors to Biden and broken down by sector?
You know, I'm afraid we're going to find out a lot of these names after the fact.
Right.
Right. No one knew that the people who started Solyndra were mega donors. No one knew their name until it was too late. And then the company went belly up. And that's probably what's going to happen again. We'll probably never have anyone connect the dots between who the donors are and what the companies are, but they will go belly up again. And the reason why is not because of any political ill will I may have. It's because the technology is not there yet. And no matter how much you will it into being, if the free market couldn't bring it into being, then the government's not going to bring it into reality. And again, that's the knock on wind and solar. They are very cool, and they have utility, and there's a bright and promising future. But if they worked as well as they are told, we are told they work, you wouldn't need government to force them on. You wouldn't need mandates, right? You wouldn't need – generals would be adopting them naturally. Municipalities would. Households will. But look at the – I'm sure your listeners know the Facebook ads and the Instagram ads they get all the time, or the mailers to their house. You know, here's this new government program, and act now and get a huge tax rebate if you put up solar panels. If they were so great, you wouldn't need government programs. You wouldn't need to force people to do them. And that's what the Biden administration is doing. And the names of the donors, of course, we can dig into, and we should expose who they are. But fact of the matter is, if we're going to spend, and we have spent, trillions of dollars, someone is going to make money off of that. It's just not possible otherwise. And it's curious to know what members of Congress own stock in these companies.
Yeah.
It's curious to know what cabinet members own stock in these companies. Someone is going to make a lot of money off of $5 trillion.
Well, and this is what, I almost hate to say this, but this is what the former Speaker John Boehner referred to as the transactional side of the business.
Yeah.
And I remember he would say that a lot. And I'm thinking, that was so naive. I was in my 20s when I went to Congress as a staffer. And I'm like, what is he talking about? Well, I mean, I think that some people just view the entire business of governing as one of, you know, confiscating money from the people and just dicing up a pie every year. And whoever can dice the pie up to get the most contributions back in return from their constituencies, they're feeding with taxpayer money, will win the next election and be in power. And it's easy to see how this gets out of control. And the Democrats had to create those constituencies, hence the Green Movement, right? Like, there was no demand for solar power 30 years ago, really. There's no demand for wind power, no demand for electric vehicles, no demand for carbon capture. It's kind of like the eyelash, you know, market. It's like you just make it up. It didn't exist 30 years ago. You create markets. You create things that people now suddenly need, and voila, there are these new constituencies who can turn out money and votes for you. And the scarier part that you just hit on, Daniel, is how many members of Congress are invested in these companies? Because Congress did not ban insider trading for itself until very recently, which was should have been like the mega scandal of the century. And all the same, that doesn't stop them from being invested in companies that they know are going to benefit eventually from government action. So there's only so much you can do. They just have to time their trading differently than before. So this is all a new a lens that I hope people will look through as they're considering these issues, because too many people are saying things aren't making sense. They make perfect sense if you're a green donor to the Biden campaign. Perfect sense. And if you're a member of Congress or a senator who is invested in green technology, because, you know, if you can triple your money, hey, or better, by locking in a requirement that the company succeeds, basically, how do you go wrong? Okay, let me take you to the Biden disapproval rate, 57%. Whoa. Harris, even worse. And I'm told, Daniel, from people who have followed this historically, that once the average price of gasoline goes above $3, it is just a guarantee presidential ratings go down. Whether it's fair or not, and here it certainly would be. I mean, he did whatever he could to make it happen. But that, I think, has to be getting their attention one way or another. What are they going to do? I mean, you point out all the things they're doing right now, this Build Back Better, $555 billion, our dollars, and giveaways to green groups continuing to ban oil and gas production on federal land. He's boxed himself in a lot. So what can he do now to try to reverse the trend in oil / gasoline prices to boost his popularity?
Yeah, I don't think he's going to reverse the trend. I think he's going to continue in this direction and, if anything, intensify. And the reason why is because in order to achieve this green revolution, they have to make the fossil fuel industry the bad guy, and they have to make the fossil fuel industry and the fossil fuels, their product, inexpensive, unattainable, right? I mean, the big oil has had a reputation of not being a beloved actor in America, and that's just the way it is. It's unfortunate. I don't think it's truthful, but that is the perception. But Americans love the product, right? And Americans love inexpensive gas. They love inexpensive food, inexpensive utility bills. And so when energy is cheap, life is cheap, and Americans appreciate that. The Biden team has to get rid of that. And so I don't think they will reverse course. I think they will make it worse and worse and worse. And that the more painful it becomes, the more likely it is Americans turn to government for a solution. And when government is turned to for the solution, they will provide one, but it will be a permanent program, as you mentioned. It will be big. It will be corrupt. It will be run by their friends. Right. And we've seen this all throughout history. Look at every big government program that came about, from Obamacare to Medicaid Part D to No Child Left Behind. Bigger and bigger programs that are less effective, cost more, and go on in perpetuity. And so to revolutionize the energy space in this country, he's going to have to get rid of fossil fuels. And the way he will do that is to make them expensive and make them hard to produce. That explains all of his mandates on fracking moratoriums, access to federal land, and make them the enemy. And then when you're on your knees, you'll turn to him, the big boy government, a big bad government, and government will be there with their solution, and their solution is green.
So let's imagine, now I've got 2 minutes left, let's imagine that the Biden-Harris team are taken out in 2024, and the next president says, Daniel Turner, you're in charge of federal energy policy. Oh, my goodness. Amen. This is a 5-alarm fire, Daniel. What are we going to do? They've destroyed our industry. We're not energy independent anymore. Help. What do you do immediately?
Yeah. There are very quick things you could do. You could end all the moratorium on fracking on federal land. You return to lease sales of federal land and offshore lease sales as well. You could go back to a lot of the infrastructure projects like Keystone, like Line 3, Line 5. You'd create a climate to let the energy industry know, I'm not going to come after you and persecute you. Biden's taken a lot of actions that have crippled supply, but those actions also have scared off people. Who's going to drill right now if you know that the EPA is going to come after you, if you know that John Kerry is going to lionize you, demonize you in the media, right? Who's going to take any action? Who's going to propose a refinery, a pipeline? So everyone has their head down. So there are some immediate steps you can take, but more than anything else, you can create that climate to say America is back. Not Joe Biden way, the previous administration's way. America is back. It is a place to do business. And it took probably 2 years for President Trump's actions to be felt. 2019 was when we first started feeling the effects of it. It will take some time, but it will happen. It's the free markets and it's the American spirit. It will happen.
We're talking with Daniel Turner, and he is the executive director of Power the Future. Daniel, thanks so much.
Thank you, Jackie.
You're listening to The Jackie Daily Show. You're listening to The Jackie Daily Show. If you haven't seen what's going on with Phelim McAleer, my friend Phelim, over at his nonprofit, which is the filmmaking nonprofit, he's very famous for his films on fracking and also the Ferguson situation in Missouri, where he just did an entire play of nothing but the grand jury testimony of what happened. Also, the film on America's top serial killer, Kermit Gosnell. Remember that awful guy, the late-term abortionist up in Philadelphia? Phelan McAleer did his film based on, again, the grand jury testimony in that case. So he does really edgy things that other woke people in the film industry would not do, and really is the most bold and brave investigative reporter I might know. He was covering Northern Ireland back when they had what they called the Troubles, a war in Ireland, as you might remember, branching from, you know, times way back between Protestants and Catholics, which carried on into the 20th century. So he started there. Well, now he's doing a film that's all about Hunter Biden. And actually, I can't wait to see it. He sent out an email, and the subject is, guess who is helping China? Again. Dear friend, the New York Times has just published a story showing how Hunter Biden profited in a billion-dollar deal to ensure China wins the energy race. The energy race. And we're talking about oil, coal, natural gas. We're talking about the Bidens, because I think it was Hunter and his uncle, you know, boosting or propping up or advising foreign fossil fuels while dad wars against their competition here in the United States. And this story was broken way back in 2020 by a conservative journalist before the election. It was ignored. Now the New York Times is freely admitting it and doing their own story now that it doesn't make any difference in the election. So here's the deal. The Hunter Biden movie is all about this and other facts like the laptop, things you want to know about Hunter Biden, but the mainstream media won't tell you. So again, put together by Phelan McAleer, he says, we've assembled an amazing cast, including canceled Mandalorian star Gina Carano and directed by Hollywood legend Robert Davi. He's asking for a contribution. I love Phelan. There's a reason why I'm on the donor list. Okay, I'll confess it. I'm a monthly donor to Phelan McAleer. I love that guy. He's been on the show a few times. And back when he was making films about fracking, it was called Frack Nation. And all those claims and videos you saw about water being lit on fire from a sink, you know, here in Texas and in Colorado, he debunks all of it. Unfortunately, it's one of those situations like Mark Twain talks about. You know, a lie makes its way around the world seven times before the truth gets its bootlaces laced up. And Phelan made this amazing film, but it did not get nearly the circulation of what Josh Fox's film he was rebutting. I blocked it out. Gasland. It's called Gasland, remember? And then he continued making films like it was called Pink Sky. There was one about the alleged breast cancer spike here in Texas, which also was debunked. On and on. I mean, I've covered this extensively in earlier shows, so I won't go into all of it. But check out Phelan McAleer's film. I just want to direct you to it. You can find him at underreportedstorysociety.com. All about Hunter Biden's work to make China the dominant energy power in a billion-dollar deal. It wasn't just China, by the way. He also had those strange dealings in Ukraine. People forget these were energy deals. You know, he wasn't selling Jimmy Choo shoes. This is fossil fuels. I thought that the Biden family hated fossil fuels. I do segments constantly about Joe Biden trying to take out American producers, which is really taking out the competition that Hunter Biden and his uncle are helping. Do you see the connection? So, there's that. Okay, and my friend Mark Morano, remember him over at Climate Depot? Sent over an amazing commentary and email. Apparently, the UN is putting together, through the World Health Organization, a new governing body. It's kind of like the International Panel on Climate Change. It's going to put together a legally binding agreement that can do things like enforce global lockdowns. You knew it was just a matter of time, right? The IPCC, which is International Panel on Climate Change, model will be used. And the reason this is connected is because solving climate change and solving a global pandemic both require global jurisdiction, right? This is the excuse to seize as much power as possible. It's different than other treaties of the past where, you know, maybe we make agreements on trade, maybe we agree how we govern the oceans or something like that. This is much further reaching. So what it would do is potentially, depending on if the U.S. participates in full, it would take away the power of governors like DeSantis from being able to protect you, because U.S. federalism would be forfeited for, you know, our sovereignty handed over to the World Health Organization, you know, governing council, which would decide, the elites would decide, you do not elect them, what the mandates would be. Local elections won't matter anymore. Your local official who decides, or your governor, whether or not you're locked down, they would be effectively neutered. And this is why every decision about sovereignty is so important. And I might have told you that the day that Ted Cruz became my favorite, well, at the time, my favorite solicitor general out in the States, back then Texas, was that he took on the Bush administration at a time when they wanted to hand over our sovereignty to the UN. You probably will not remember the obscure Medellin case. But the bottom line is this. Instead of Texas, Mr. Medellin, who was an illegal alien from Mexico, committed a gang initiation ceremony on two little girls. I will not tell you what he did to them, but it was very brutal and graphic and horrible. And they ultimately died. I'm not even going to tell you what he did before an audience to earn his way into a gang. Texas put him on death row, of course. Well, then out of nowhere comes the Mexican consulate saying, oh, you didn't consult us first before trying these 57 Mexican nationals that are on Texas death row. So we ask that you please retry them and reconsider their sentences. And the Bush administration, under the direction of Condi Rice, and there was Alberto Gonzalez and Harriet Myers. Myers and Condi said to George Bush, to President Bush, you know what? Let's just do this. Let's just give Mexico what they want. They're our biggest trading partner. Wouldn't it be nice to just hand these hardened criminals back to the system and just start over? I mean, it wasn't very nice what we did. And Ted Cruz says, excuse me, you all have no authority in this. The state of Texas controls criminal law, and we decide what the criminal law will be. We decide how you're tried. We decide whether or not these people get reconsidered. We don't take them off Texas death row unless Texas says so. Bottom line, he fought them because it was going to be a UN cessation of sovereignty again from states to our federal government, ultimately the UN, because Ted Cruz beat them in the federal district court, in the Fifth Circuit, and at the U.S. Supreme Court. Oh. So then guess what? President Bush goes to the world court, the United Nations, to say, step in, UN, and say that we can hand over these prisoners. It doesn't matter, okay? The UN doesn't have any authority to tell Texas what to do. What are they going to do? Deploy troops? Bust into our prisons? Take these people out? No. So anyway, Ted Cruz is the biggest defender of U.S. sovereignty, to my knowledge, in the U.S. Senate. And this is why it matters. You don't want to hand over your power to a world body to create a permanent crisis, and it will be permanent. Climate change will be a permanent crisis, and pandemics will be a permanent crisis for which they have an excuse to lord it over you. Thank you, Ted Cruz. You're listening to The Jackie Daly Show. You're listening to The Jackie Daly Show. Find me at jackiedaly.com and on Twitter at jackiedalyhost. Subscribe for free on Spotify, iTunes, and others. After the Texas winter storm earlier in 2021, that claimed the lives of estimated hundreds of Texans, little known fact, the legislature basically had a mandate to act and do something. Governor too. And that something actually manifests itself in legislation. Some of it had a recommendation, but not a strong requirement, that there be a firming requirement. And firming means that energy providers, whether they're wind, solar, gas, coal, whatever, have to guarantee delivery of their power. If they can't do that, they get to firm it up, right, with a firming requirement. This would be hitting the wind and solar harder than others that are dispatchable, since they don't tend to have much of a problem moving power at key moments. So I was happy to see that Texas Public Policy Foundation submitted comments to the Public Utility Commission of Texas when they apparently, I'll say it my way, seem to have expressed defiance against this firming requirement. You know, somehow the legislature and the governor can make these strong statements, yet the Public Utility Commission can just say, well, we've had some meetings, maybe we don't need that. So that's how it looks to me. I'm going to ask Brent Bennett. Brent, Dr. Bennett, is the policy director at Life Powered at the Texas Public Policy Foundation. They raise America's energy IQ. They are my go-to people when it comes to energy research, especially in the state of Texas. And they have written some comments to the Public Utility Commission, or the PUC, about what needs to happen here. So, Dr. Bennett, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Jackie. It's good to be back again.
Absolutely. So, now tell me if you agree with my assessment that the legislature and the governor basically had this strong endorsement that we actually have sufficient power, like wind and solar, you are going to produce if you participate here in this market. But the Public Utility Commission, I think, is showing defiance. What's going on here?
Yeah, it's a tricky question. Yeah, I wouldn't say defiance, because I think they're communicating pretty well what they're doing. And I think that there's really a lot of disagreement about how you define firming and what that really should mean, right? So to go back, you know, and we, over a year ago, we started developing this concept and had a paper drafted prior to Winter Storm Uri. I ended up waiting to submit that until October, and of course redid a lot of it to incorporate what had happened in February. And so we have a paper that kind of outlines this firming requirement, basically saying that, you know, we should allocate reliability costs to wind and solar to the extent that they create a reliability deficit on the grid, right? That it benefits the market for them to pay that versus making ratepayers pay for all of that, right? Ultimately, the cost gets passed to ratepayers anyways, but it's more economically efficient, and it also helps to balance the subsidies, right? Because the subsidies are causing us to build too much wind and solar, right?
Let me stop you for just a second, because there's a few points in there. The first is, what we're saying is, if you're going to give us a product that only produces energy about, I don't know, 30% of the time on average, but you know we need this product all the time, including to save lives in an emergency, like lives are riding on this. The people who produce the variable or unreliable power should have to bear the cost of that. And right now, they're not.
They should have to pay for the performance gap between their performance at peak versus the performance of thermal generators, right? Otherwise, that performance gap is having to be paid for by ratepayers.
And by thermal generator, we mean coal. We mean natural gas.
Yes, and coal and natural gas and nuclear.
Yeah.
Right?
So that which is dispatchable.
Primarily in Texas.
Yeah. Okay, or traditional energy, sometimes we call it.
And so, you know, in the legislature, the Senate passed a stronger requirement that actually mandated to some extent that they do this. The House weakened that quite a bit, and it came out kind of, well, it's possible, but they could easily, the statute is, you know, allows for them to get around having to make a Fermi requirement if they don't want to. right. And but the Senate was pretty clear, and the Senate, and that was reiterated in a hearing this summer. The Senate was pretty clear that they wanted them to do that. So, you know, we have at least one house, at least one of the two houses is very clear on that. The other is not against the idea. The House isn't necessarily against the idea. They're just, they are not, you know, they're not all for it right now. But, of course, Governor Abbott came out and wrote a great letter back at the beginning of July and said, you know, we think that the PUC should do this. And that's TPPF's interpretation, is that that letter is pretty clear. Now, there's not a mandate there, right? The governor can't write an executive order to tell the public utility commissioners what to do. They're only bound by what's in statute. And so that's, you know, again, there's just still discretion there, right? But the governor seemed to make his preference pretty clear. To this point so far, the Public Utility Commission has instituted a set of what they call phase one reforms, which are more near term. And those are pretty good. And they're actually having a very serious discussion about some of the reliability costs related to day-to-day variability caused by wind and solar. So, you know, when the sun goes down at night and then you have to ramp up, you know, your other generators to make up the difference, right, all that solar going away.
Mm-hmm.
There's going to be a lot of discussion. There has been and there will be a lot of discussion about allocating some of those costs to wind and solar. So that's a good thing. That's going with the direction in the governor's letter to allocate reliability costs. The problem is that they're kind of stopping there, and they're not considering the more what you just talked about, right? The longer term backup power that's required to make up for the performance gap, right, with thermal, right? And so that's where there's a problem, is that they're kind of at this point they're just stopping with that initial phase of reforms, and they, for the purposes of the longer term market reforms, they're right now not considering that. They're only considering proposals that are basically saying, okay, ratepayers have to pay for backup power in some form.
So right. to refresh our memory, because I haven't looked at this in a while,
yeah.
My understanding is that wind and solar perform the worst when you need them most, whether it's during a hurricane in Houston or whether it's during a winter storm in West Texas. That's precisely when their output collapses. So remind me of the time in the middle of the storm at its worst. Wasn't it true that renewables produced, I think it was wind in particular, at about 1.5% of its capacity, while natural gas had to ramp up 400%? Is that what you remember? Like, what was the renewable production at the lowest point?
Yeah, well, natural gas increased a lot prior to the storm, right? And then it dropped off some during the storm, right? But prior to the storm, we were producing all out, right? But yes, with wind and solar, you're correct. At the height of the storm, they were producing about 2% of their installed capacity. So their installed capacity is there with the maximum that they can produce, right? And
yes.
At the height of the storm, they were producing 2% of that. And kind of the way I put it is that, you know, we've invested over $60 billion in that infrastructure for wind and solar generation in the state. And we had $60 billion of generation that was producing, you know, less than 2% of our energy.
That's an outrage. When
we need it the most, right? So that's, again, that's not necessarily the wind and solar guys' fault, right? Like, we know this is what happens.
Yeah, we know they don't work in a storm.
Yeah, like, it's not a mystery, right? The problem is our market design that allows them to do this and yet still make money in our market, right?
Yeah, at a time
and
when...
And that goes back to the subsidies and the price distortions that we've allowed to exist in our market.
At a time when lives are being lost, and I think it's important to say before I cut to break, we're saying... We're not saying we have to distinguish between capacity and generation. It's one thing to talk about the capacity of wind or solar. It's quite another to talk about the generation, what they actually produce. And that's
what
we're talking about.
When that generation occurs.
Yeah, and when it occurs. Because people, I mean, policymakers love to talk about capacity, which they never meet. It's not like the wind is blowing 100% of the time at a super high rate. It's just not. So anyway, I got to cut to break. But when we come back, we'll continue a conversation with Brent Bennett. And Brent, I didn't tell you ahead of time to look at this, but I'm going to read to you an excerpt from a competing think tank commenting a little bit differently than you on this topic, and get your response. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Jackie Daly Show, and I'm continuing a conversation with Dr. Brent Bennett of the Texas Public Policy Foundation's Life Powered Program. We're talking about the winter storm in Texas that claimed hundreds of Texan lives in February 2021. And now we see the state of Texas, after its legislature and executive branch pushed hard to force wind and solar producers to have backup power or some way to firm up their output when it's needed, however they want to do that. Now we see the Public Utility Commission unanimously voting to take that firming standard off the table, which is a disaster. I call it defiance. Others might not. But Brent, I want to read to you an excerpt from an article by an acquaintance of mine here in Dallas, Tom Giovanetti, CEO of the IPI think tank. Here was his commentary very recently. I'm just going to read it verbatim. Quote, "The good news is that there is new generation in the works, mostly focused on renewables. But we need new gas plants as well to have a diversified portfolio to meet seasonal circumstances. The worst thing we could do is reduce supply. The wrong lesson to take from the freeze is that we need fewer renewables, and the wrong solution is to punish renewables. It is a policy misjudgment to pit one energy source for electrical generation against another. Defending fossil fuels does not require trashing renewables or vice versa." Okay, so that's enough of that. So, Brent, what is your reaction?
I would say in a perfect world, he's right. That is not the world we live in, right? We live in a world where we have a market that relies on prices, and those prices are heavily distorted by subsidies. And so we have to counteract that. It's not about punishing renewables. It's not about punishing wind and solar. It's that if our market is going to continue to function, we have to do something to counteract the subsidies that are driving the overbuilding of wind and solar, right? And so it is absolutely possible to have too much supply of one type of resource because you're valuing certain characteristics of that resource at the expense of others. And the characteristic of wind and solar is that they can produce energy cheaply and with no emissions at random times of the day, but they can't produce it when we need it, right? Because you have to be able to store it. And the storage is really expensive, right? Whereas fossil fuels are cheap energy storage. So to say that we just need more of everything is not the right answer, right? We need more of the right kinds of energy that's valuing the things that we need the most right now. And that's energy when we are demanding it, right? When it's needed. So Yeah, I think in a perfect world, and when we have a market that is functioning and that properly values the different aspects of our different energy sources, then I think he's right. But that is not the world that we live in. Absolutely not.
No, and I feel like that there is, it's not a zero-sum game, the market, but a state budget is. And since so much of the money is coming from the government and not from the market, there is a finite amount of money at any given moment that Texas can put toward solving this problem. And I'm not calling for subsidies of anything, but to the extent they're going to take my money and give it away, I do think I should have some say-so. If that's what they're going to do, I should have an opinion about that. And it was pointed out I think by Robert Bryce. Imagine if we had taken the $60 billion we invested in wind and solar and put that into natural gas, coal, or nuclear generation. Brent, would there have been a Winter Storm Uri outage that took the lives of hundreds of Texans? What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think so. I mean, it's hard to create a definitive answer, but I think it's pretty clear that even if we'd just taken, say, $30 billion of that $60 billion and invested it in our gas supply and all the things that we're going to, you know, invest money in trying to winterize now, you know, and invested in maintaining all the power plants that we have prematurely retired prior to the storm. And we prematurely retired like something about 8 gigawatts, so which is 10% of our total generation. We replaced a little bit of that, but we've lost about 5% on net gas and coal generation. So think if we had maintained that, right, that would have helped a lot during the storm, whereas we had, again, $60 billion of infrastructure that was producing less than 2% of our electricity at the height of the storm, right? So that's, I think, yeah, it's absolutely right that, you know, it's not an unlimited pie, right? There's a limited amount of electricity demand in Texas. The demand is growing, but it's still limited, right? We can't export that electricity very easily, right? And then there's also a limited supply of money that we have to invest in our system to meet demand. And right now, the problem with the Public Utility Commission's proposals is that they're basically going to throw more money at everything, right? They're kind of adopting that stance of, let's just, okay, we're not going to cut back on the subsidies to wind and solar. We're just going to try and subsidize other resources more now to make up the difference, mm-hmm. right?
Right.
And really you need the most, which if you do it right, may give us enough generation, but it's going to be very expensive,
yeah.
right? And whereas the most efficient way to solve the problem is to fix the overinvestment in wind and solar, and at the same time, you're trying to fix the underinvestment in other generation. And that's what our firming requirement idea accomplishes, right? That's why we designed it that way. And,
yeah.
and unfortunately, the trend is to just throw more money at everything instead of actually doing something more targeted that would fix the problem.
And by throwing money at everything, what they do is the legislators or the whoever is not alienating any constituency, you know, that mm-hmm. might be giving contributions. I can't help but think about how much the renewable industry is giving into political, you know, campaigns or whatever. So consider
yeah.
the problem. We have the population growing in Texas every single day by thousands of people. And that's the legal immigration. Then there are, you know, 1 million to 2 million people crossing the border. And some of those people move on out of Texas. Some of them don't. It is a huge burden that the state bears disproportionately to the rest of the country, having this huge border, porous border. So it's a lot of people to provide for. I only have 3 minutes left, but can you explain, given the demand that we had in February, the February storm, that has only grown, people have no idea how bad things could have gotten back then if the grid had collapsed, basically. We were just like minutes away from grid collapse. People don't really understand what that means and what the consequence could be. Could you explain what that would look like?
Yeah, it's hard to explain, but we would have had, at that point, we would have had, you know, complete loss of electricity across the entire state, and it would have taken us weeks probably to get it back on. What would have to happen is you'd have individual power plants that start back up and re-energize portions of the grid, and then you start to connect them together over time, and it's a very controlled, difficult process because it's a synchronized system and you have to keep everything in sync. And it would have taken probably weeks for some areas to return to have power restored. And it's only, I can't even imagine the devastation that would have wrought, how many more people would have died, because so many people's lives were saved by the fact that they were able to go and seek out shelter in a place that did have power, or at least had some power, you know, and then after 3 days it was done. Whereas if it had been 3 weeks, goodness, it's hard to imagine. And at some point we've talked to people, at some point somebody should do a video about that.
Yeah, because you know, there's a book called 1 Second After, by Bill Forstjen. And it's a work of fiction that tries to illustrate what would happen if the grid were attacked in a, you know, literally a military operation, and went down for months. And I had him on the show to talk about that. And he walks you through, you know, at day 4, people have no water and they get desperate. You know, the second week they're out of food. Now things get crazier. You know, obviously you can't get medicine. People can't get dialysis. You know, it would be a mass casualty event. And this is lost on people. And we have no idea how long it would last, really. It's not like we've been here before. So it's critically important that we get this right. And now the you know, Texans can lose a little bit of hope here with how the Public Utility Commission is behaving, not fixing the problem that we had back in February. After all we've been through, they're unanimously taking the firming requirement off the table. So they say it might be for the legislators to address this again at a later date. I'm talking to Dr. Brent Bennett with the Life Powered Program at Texas Public Policy Foundation. And you can find his work at texaspolicy.com. Dr. Bennett, thanks for coming on.
Yeah, thank you, Jackie. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. You're listening to The Jackie Daly Show. We'll take a break. You're listening to The Jackie Daly Show. Listen, I told you earlier about the new film by Phelan McAleer, which is all about Hunter Biden. And I told you the wrong website. Phelan has more than one site. For this film, go to mysonhunter.com. Mysonhunter.com. Again, this is the film starring Gina Carano and directed by Hollywood legend Robert Dobby. It's all about Hunter Biden's billion-dollar deal to ensure that China wins the energy race. Wins the energy race. This is not a work of fiction. This is biographical. This is covering the story that the press covered up for the Bidens before the election, and now the New York Times is at least publishing a story telling the truth about it. Finally, we're almost a year out or more from the election, and they finally decide, well, maybe we can go ahead and let this out. What they're doing is defanging it. Defang. They know it's going to come out even in their press eventually. It was out in the conservative press way back in 2020. And the Media Research Center did an amazing study about stories that were covered up and just how much the two sides have an echo chamber. For example, the story of the Hunter Biden laptop, what Trump called the laptop from hell, that contained key evidence in this deal, this billion-dollar deal that Hunter did with the Chinese, and it's all about fossil fuels. And apparently, a very significant portion of liberal America knew nothing about it. They went to the polls, voted, they were polled after the election, and they claimed they had never even heard about the story, which just proves they don't listen to the Jackie Daly Show. That's okay. They would not enjoy it. I understand. But the point is that we're in this echo chamber, and really, to reach across the aisle, you need very skilled filmmakers like Phelan McAleer. I think he's done some of the best work as an investigative journalist anywhere in my lifetime. And so I recommend you check him out and his past movies like Frack Nation, debunking all the stories about people lighting their water on fire in their house, or stories about breast cancer and fracking. He debunks it all beautifully with humor and charm. He has a very delightful Irish accent, and I highly commend it to you. Again, it's called mysonhunter.com. All right, and I'm now going to move on to my latest area of obsession, which is defamation law. Defamation law. Been studying up. You know something? this country has this amazing, strong bias toward free speech. As a general rule, you can say anything you want. And as you've noticed from watching certain media outlets, doesn't even have to be true. You can say just about anything you want about a public figure, especially because we want people to speak freely about their leaders, to be as critical as they want to be. Part of what makes us different is the degree of freedom to say what we want. At least up until the past few years. But this is by and large a good thing, because if you have it otherwise, there's only one other regime to free speech, and that is government elites telling you what you will and will not say, period. Those are your options. People speak freely, or you're controlled by some unelected bureaucrat somewhere. It's that simple. So chalk me up as a free speech advocate. We have really a long, long tradition undergirding this law, at least this country, because we borrowed from the British common law. And a beautiful maxim from the British common law, which you would see in the 13 colonies and throughout our law today, quote, "A good name is rather to be chosen than great riches," unquote. And so, while you may speak freely, there is a limit to what you can say about other people, especially people who are not public figures. You know, if it's the president, no one cares what you say. If it's some person next door who did not inject themselves into the public debate, or even who did, but who is not a public figure per se, well, then there can actually be a penalty extracted in damages, that is money, if you injure their reputation unfairly or untruly. So, as a general rule, in most states, if someone injures your reputation and they do that unlawfully, that means they committed a tort, not a crime, a tort, right? This is not a prosecutor that will come after you yet. Thank God. It's a civil action. These are lawsuits seeking compensation for damage to your reputation. What you have to show, as a general rule, is the harm you suffered, that there was a publication, whether it was written or spoken, and identification. So people knew it was you they were talking about. Maybe they named you by name. Maybe they didn't. So usually the person being defamed has to become less productive, less valuable, or less useful, a member of the community, as a result of the defamation. So imagine you're a professional and someone assaults your integrity. Well, now people don't want to hire you, and the allegation was false. That's a perfect example. Or it can be your morals. I mean, especially 100 years ago, if you attacked a woman's chastity and that was a false accusation, she could sue you. If you accuse someone of having a loathsome disease, they can sue you. It's there are some things out there that are kind of like actionable per se, meaning it doesn't require proof of special damages. Examples include accusations of fornication. Yeah. Made in a religious assembly. As late as this decade, a Georgia court has awarded a plaintiff more than $500,000 for such a thing happening. Basically, the statement has to be something that exposes a person to public hatred, contempt, or ridicule. So, the statement has to be false, and malicious. And this can be a statement even by implication or sometimes by omission, something you did not say. Every state is different. But sometimes if you don't add something, a qualifier apparently, you can be sued in some states. Often you must show malice. You've probably heard the word malice used in legal forums, and it can be inferred from the character of the charge. It means ill will, spite, hatred, or charges deliberately calculated to injure one's reputation. So, know this. Even if acting with malice, the complete defense to defamation suits is truth. If it's true, you can say it. In this country, no one has a right to not have their feelings hurt. Period. No matter what the woke crowd alleges, you have no right to protection of your feelings under the U.S. Constitution and, frankly, under most statutes. It shouldn't be under any statutes, but sometimes some people try to bend them for damages for emotional distress or something like that. That's probably a bad idea because, again, now you have a court policing speech or expression or tempest in a teapot kind of interpersonal disputes. But I'm only scratching the surface. But this kind of legal regime is why we have so much, really, false information circulating because there's basically no penalty for most of it. There's no penalty. The only cure for false speech or bad speech is good speech in this country. And as bad as that can feel or seem to experience, the truth is it's far preferable to the alternative, which is government-controlled speech. So that is your quick primer on defamation. I have so much more. I've actually devoted hours to thinking about it lately and studying up, but I'm out of time this segment. You're listening to The Jackie Daly Show. You're listening to The Jackie Daly Show, and one of the people in the next room who heard my last segment rushed into the studio when I finished and said, give me more defamation law. And I think he was joking. I think he was kind of oh, no, they're shaking their head. No, they're not bored. I think defamation law is fascinating. It's all about free speech. I mean, what is the blaze about? What is the Jackie Daly Show about, if not free speech? And I am a passionate advocate and defender. You know, I've taken the oath many times to uphold and defend the U.S. Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. Many times. In fact, I've read it on air, and I'm serious. I can't even recite it without tearing up. I am so, so committed. So committed. And very proud to be an American, and even proud of my profession. I'm not only the host of the Jackie Daly Show, I'm actually a lawyer, believe it or not. And very proud of what I've done with my life, and feel that there needs to be right now a full throttle defense of free speech, because right this second, I think you could say that freedom of speech has never been stronger under the law, not in practice, and free exercise of religion, also religious liberty, has never been stronger under the law. I mean, the precedents we have right now at the U.S. Supreme Court are about as good as it gets. It doesn't get much more broad than that. But as Greg Lukianoff reminded us on this show, in his talking about his book, The Coddling of the American Mind, you know, we may have these great freedoms now, but if we lose the culture of free speech, or the culture that is cherishes faith as sovereign heart and mind, then we're only one generation away from losing these freedoms. That Supreme Court can change fast. You know, if we have enough people who don't honor the rule of law, who would pack the court, they can flip it right now. And we're 2 years away from God knows what. So it's an all the time thing that the defense of freedom, the price of freedom, is eternal vigilance, is what they told us. And so I just feel like we can't say it enough right now. We even have to find more charming ways to say it. Yeah, you know, Ben Shapiro says the facts don't care about your feelings. We used to tell people to buck up and get tough, and apparently that language is not welcomed anymore. I mean, it's obvious the aggregate testosterone level has fallen such that you can't even have a conversation with people anymore without them melting down and, calling some arbitrator to get in between you. I learned from Greg's book that the younger generation is actually trained now from the time they're in elementary school to not solve their own problems with communication. Instead, they are trained to run to the teacher, run to HR, run to a guidance counselor, find a government-sponsored arbitrator to get between them and, like, another student. In other words, there's not even unsupervised play anymore. The way that you and I would just run out into the street and come back when the streetlights came on at night and no one was really arbitrating anything or supervising anything, and you had to learn to survive and defend yourself and make arguments and push back on people. Kids don't do that anymore. Everything has a mediator. And then this goes with them into the workplace. And instead of having a conversation with a boss, they call their parents if something doesn't go their way to be an intermediator. It's crazy. But the end result, perversely, is the death of free speech. Because anything you say suddenly can and will be used against you. Maybe not in a court of law, but at your job, you know, in your workplace. You can be sanctioned by the HR department if you said something that someone doesn't like. There's these tyrants who decide what the prevailing ideology is. And this is completely foreign to the American culture. It's destructive to everything, to free thinking and innovation and intelligence quotient, growth spurts. I mean, everything. It has to stop. So anyway, I'm here to defend free speech. That's what I'm trying to say about this, which is one reason why I'm teaching you defamation law, so you can defend yourself. But at the same time, know that as a general rule, it is for you to speak for yourself. It is not for you to run to a court unless and until someone damages your reputation. Anyway, I went over all that last segment. I'm not going to do it again. I've already been told. They've had enough. Okay. I am reading up again the work by Jørgen Lomborg. Jørgen Lomborg, president of the Copenhagen Consensus, visiting fellow at Hoover Institute. Institution. I'm sorry. You know what? I need a nap. His latest book that I share with you, and had him on the show, you might remember. He was on Zoom with me. It's called False Alarm, How Climate Change Panic Costs Us Trillions, Hurts the Poor, and Fails to Fix the Planet. And I love that he reiterates that, I don't care what you've heard, warming annually causes about 120,000 heat deaths. Heat deaths, but prevents nearly 300,000 cold deaths. And so there's just voluminous historical evidence that humankind tends to thrive during times of warming. So the cyclical warming periods are when you see the great civilizations bloom and farming takes off. and a greater percentage of the land you can use. And people move north. And it's a good time. And then when the planet cools, actually, civilizations decline. And so that's the broad scale, like, you know, 6,000 year view. But there's much more we could say. Apparently, there's a new study showing that rivers around the world now flood less. 10,000 rivers overall. What used to be a 50-year flood in the 70s happens about every 152 years today. That's not because the planet has changed so dramatically. It's because of urbanization, flood control measures, and changes in the climate. All of the above. But you would never know it by reading the news. Things are actually better. I've done a lot of segments about how life has never been better. And it's true. I mean, I find people complaining and ready to tear the system down at just the time when the world has never been better. And what I mean by that is, in 1980, the number of people living in abject poverty, the people you remember, you saw them on those long fundraising marathons out of Ethiopia, you know, there were a lot of people on the planet who lived that way. Now, that's going down about 90%. We are feeding more people than ever before, housing more people are having health care, just basically having a higher standard of living than ever before. But the good news never makes its way to the press. It just doesn't sell. Which reminds me of another book, Trust Me, I'm Lying, which explains why only that which bleeds leads and that which makes you angry gets clicks, and clicks are revenue. And that's what it's all about, unfortunately. And that's one reason why people are depressed. That's one reason why, you know, almost 50% of young women under the age of 25 express concerns, depression, or even suicidal thoughts about climate change. It's an amazing statistic of people who are having their mental health damaged by negative stories when there are so many great stories out there. I mean, climate-related deaths have dropped to fewer than 20,000 on average every year, even though the global population has quadrupled since 1920, back when natural disasters killed about 500,000 people on average every year. I said 1920, about 500,000 people died every year from climate-related deaths. Now it's 20,000. Because of improved technology. You know, we actually see the storm coming. We have a satellite to tell us to get out of the way. You've never been safer. You've never been safer from massive floods, hurricanes, droughts, wildfires, because of technology. So don't let anyone tell you that you don't have it better than your parents, your grandparents, and your great-grandparents. It is an amazing time to be alive. In gratitude is the secret to happiness. Believe me. You're listening to The Jackie Daly Show.